and you're here.
Yeah, and I regret that thought. I can't be on my computer waiting for the store to come back up so I can get my order in, just like a normal person. And if it comes out on the 16th, I gosh darn, I have a speech somewhere on the 16th. Could I wait in line all night that night and still make my speech? Maybe. I'd love to do that. You know, it's like waiting in line when you're in college for a concert ticket to the Rolling Stones. I mean, you'll wait all night and be one of the first ones to buy a ticket. So these are important events in life to me.
So you don't have the iPad 3 here.
I can't say.
So we got another interesting question here. Shift gears a little bit here. So can we predict and prevent terrorist strikes and attacks leveraging the wisdom of crowds?
The wisdom, because of using the wisdom of crowds?
Yeah, like, you know, wow. Looking around here and you're...
I think that terrorists try to be very secretive and hidden, and I'm not sure. I don't know. I do know one thing, that when I was pulling a lot of pranks, I learned how not to get caught. You don't tell a soul. You tell one person, if you think you trust, man, it leaks a little bit. No. So, but I don't know. I think that terrorist detection is done a lot electronically now. Email and all that. Not very many people use encryption.
And we threw that in just to prove that we really are taking real questions here. I would have never came up with that one. So what's it like tinkering in the garage, you know, going to the computer fair, showing off the Apple One with Steve in the early days, just going around?
Well, that was pretty amazing because, first of all, I got inspired by all these social changes that computers were going to mean, and I said, I'm good at designing computers. I finally saw the formula to design one that I could afford that was the computer I wanted, and it wasn't the computer I'd built 5 years before, the one when I met Steve Jobs. That was a computer with switches and lights. A front panel, if you will. Push a button and some ones and zeros go into memory. This was going to be a computer you could really type programs into. And I saw that the formula was possible. And I said, I'm going to design it. And then, of course, I was designing it for the other people in my club. So what did I do? I passed out the schematics. I passed out the listings. No copyright notices. No intent to have a company. And then Steve came by and saw it. He came back from Oregon from another. He was working on an orchard or something up there. And he came back and he said, oh my gosh, we could sell this too. We could make a PC board. At first, he said we'd make a PC board for $20 and sell it for $40 because we didn't have any money. So we couldn't make a computer. But one thing snowballed into another, and Hewlett-Packard kept turning me down. So that was just the most exciting time in life because talking about a revolution, and part of the world was saying, oh, it's going to be nothing, not important financially. And from everything they had to make their decisions with, they were probably right. But then who would ever expect that something like Game Boy would come about? Or market research, IBM's market research would have been all the people using computers. Would they have a need for a tiny machine based on a microprocessor? Oh, no, no, the tasks they're doing would never be fulfilled by that. And the trouble is they didn't have a way to do market research among people that didn't use computers yet. Dentists, teachers, lawyers, doctors, you know, those kind of people. All of us, engineers. So there was a market there, but it was really hard to predict. And that was kind of neat because it gave us a lot of motivation and spirit that part of the world didn't believe it. And we were onto a revolution. We're changing things. We're doing something as important as, you know, the revolution of the United States, you know. So that's how it was for us.
Yeah, no, really.
And every little 2 weeks when somebody showed something off new at the club, oh my God, the world has changed forever. Things are every little, and after we started Apple, every week or so something new came out. Oh my gosh, the world is never going to be the same. So much change so quickly. It was very radical at first.
So were things changing more rapidly back, let's say, in the 90s or now?
Oh my gosh, things are changing much more rapidly now, I think, because the ways we're doing the mobile transition and the way everything you do in your life and all the apps are starting to define my life and my abilities, and they're just exploding. So many people can write apps, and young people and old people, and you don't have to be a real big, huge corporation to have a successful app on a phone, yet it can be so useful. And almost every business incorporating iPads and iPhones and stuff like that into their own communication structure. So now I think things are changing very fast right now, and we're getting to the point where the computers are getting much more human. I mean, the Macintosh was a huge change because all of a sudden things were sort of human. Instead of a screen, you had a human desktop. And you had words like pages. You had words that were human words. You had pictures that looked like things they represented. So that was a huge change, but that towards the humanness. Even back in the Apple II days, when somebody put out a little board you could plug in your Apple II, and it spoke with a natural human voice instead of some little computer squeaky voice, that was really good. And it was good and attractive. It was a step towards humanism. And now we're getting to where we're talking to our phones like they're a person. We don't have to be careful about our words. We don't have to be careful about our grammar. We just speak in a natural thought, and it seems to understand us sometimes. I think that's the future, is Siri turning into Watson. That sort of, that might be a big direction in the future. And look at the little iPhone I carry in my pocket. Is it going to be a best friend ever? Well, it's already got senses that I as a human have. It can sense touch, like I can. It can hear. It can see with a camera. It knows when it's moving, like your inner ear. Now, it can tell where it is in the world with GPS, and when I wake up, I don't know where I am. but I can still smell, and I can taste. So we got to, maybe those are the real cues to getting a conscious computer. It's got to want taste.
I have a follow-up. Mark Zuckerberg and Eric Schur have both said, you know, not Eric Schur, Eric Schmidt. Eric Schur.
Sure,
thank you. Yeah, wrong.
You're like me.
Eric, the guy from Google. I'm terrible with names. I want an app that I can point at somebody and say, oh, that's so-and-so, and you really don't want to talk with them because last time you insulted them or something like that.
I used to talk to my young son who's really, you know, gifted in computer science, you know, about virtual reality and what you can do, and he would point out to me, oh, no, AR, augmented reality.
Reality is just so beautiful, and the apps I've used, they're fun so far. But everything great starts out as fun.
But what you're saying, I think we're getting very close to, a lot of people are working on exactly what you described.
Yeah.
Some sort of glasses that kind of put up little notes like you see in the movies, telling you, this is so-and-so, blah, 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 age.
So these two guys whose last names I can't remember, they say privacy is dead. What do you think?
Unfortunately, you know what? I was one of the slow ones to come along and realize that, because I had other friends that just pointed out, you know, every time you spoke, they're doing this and it's going to take some privacy away from us. Steve, we've already lost it all, so who cares? You know what? I just realized, how much privacy do you have? Everywhere you go, every transaction you do, there's little cameras watching you anywhere. I try to think of how I would do a perfect crime and avoid detection. It's very difficult. It's a good thing. Very difficult. I mean, even things like, oh my, can I tell my phone it's in a different place? Well, I can either plug in a phony GPS or I can create a GPS signal, but my phone is still going to link into some cell tower in Sacramento where I do the murder.
You could have gone down a really different path.
My sister predicted I'd either be in jail or famous.
Well, it worked out pretty well for you.
So things are moving more rapidly now than they were 10 years ago. What about in 2020?
In my mind, things are going so fast. But, you know, as we get older, too, you watch the young kids, you don't even understand what they're doing and the fullness of their little mobile computing life. And I never thought I'd get to that way, that I could communicate with all the young kids about computers and technology and how to use it.
But we'll be,
makes it seem like it's moving faster yet.
Today, but what about in 2020? 10 years from now, will it be moving even faster?
I think it's going to become very much more invisible and natural, and might be just like your watch, like the iPod Nano that you can scroll through. I think you'll just pick it up and ask it questions all day long, like you normally would ask people questions, or you'd look at an encyclopedia and try to get a few answers about the world and where you are and something that comes up. I really want don't want answer engines, I don't want search engines.
Except, so the question here is, at what point in the future will the innovation start to slow down? Because we've been on this accelerating path. Is it 2050? Is it 20 never? At some point.
Sure, but you're asking a question nobody can answer.
I didn't.
You know, is there a God?
So it's going to keep going, right?
Yeah, how old is the universe? When is the universe going to end? I don't know. We have this desire in us to always create things and to change them and to come up with every change we sort of see as being better, a little improvement of one sort, a little improvement of another. And we use mathematics, we use science, we create new materials, and who knows when we're going to someday discover a next new material that works its way up the chain for another 100 years, changing all technology it's based on. Optical computing, maybe that'll come.
One thing that strikes me about knowing you in your life is that I get the sense it's not the technology that's interesting. It keeps going and going, but it's a matter of remaining human in the midst of that and enjoying life.
Well, you know, in Apple, especially, it became very important to me from a guy that came into Apple and taught Steve Jobs and I that you can either, it's human versus technology. The human is important. What you have to do is put all the effort into making the technology work the human ways, the natural human ways, or you can make the human have to relearn everything and do it the technology way, and that's where the technology is more important. So I've always been such a fan of the human should be more important, and this humanness, and I've seen the effects of it when it's in the computer. It drags students to want to look at a screen if it seems more like a human. I think someday, once we have a conscious computer, it'll be a great teacher, a replacement for a human. And, you know, I actually see kids walking around with their little products saying, this is my best friend, get out of my life, it knows me, you don't know me, you know, to their own parents.
Is that a good thing?
Is that a good thing? You know, there's different, I think that when it's happening, people will say it's good. The people doing it will say it's good. So we're sort of judging it from our perspective of having grown up with newspapers and real paper books and things like that. And it's just sort of like some days, if you can't beat them, join them.
All right, back to the questions here. So given your experience with innovation at Apple, what advice would you give IBM?
You know, first of all, Apple, when we founded Apple, and we had one funder, and he was really the mentor, the older person that had run business before, he told Steve Jobs that his role would be to learn how to do everything, every department works in a company. My role would be engineering. We'd have to hire a president to make sure all the right things are being attended to, get a couple operations guys, an accountant. He sort of was the mentor that really made Apple. And he said, right, and he was the one who made the comment about IBM is just a group of people, and we can create products just as well as they can. And what was the question exactly? What advice would I give? One thing he said, first day we're in our little tiny, you know, our first office was about the size of the stage. And he said to Steve, he said, you know, we're going to be a marketing-driven company. Because I came from Hewlett Packard in the days when it only built products for engineers. And it was totally engineering-driven. Because every engineer designing things was designing them for engineers. And they were part of the market. But now we're going to be a marketing-driven company. He said that's the most important thing, you know, knowing that he had been in engineering and he'd been in marketing and Intel. And he said IBM is so powerful and successful because they are a marketing-driven company. So it's really understanding the needs of customers and having a good feel for, you know, products and pricing, how you make products look. What are your advertisements like? They're showing images of how you know, given the brain ideas that aren't necessarily written in words. So we've always been very admiring of IBM in that regard. As far as innovation within the company, you know, you've almost got to have it as a major goal from the top down. Because even in Apple, it's easy to see that you can have a very innovative top level and then middle layers of management can really destroy things. And there's no way to ever get to them all and watch them all. There's no way to judge when a manager gets stale. A manager really has got to appreciate, make the younger, the people underneath him feel like they're so important and what they're doing is going to make them so outstanding. And put those personal meanings into the work they're doing. You know, it's hard to say what it is. And also be attentive to who's really got some good ideas. They don't have to come from above. Hewlett Packard, when we worked there, we had a company philosophy. The best ideas were up and down. Communication could be any level in the company. And most of the great products that drove the divisions for the next 10 years would just come from an engineering group. You know, bottom of the org chart. So I felt really good then. I always wanted that kind of feeling. I don't even think Apple came that far.
Interesting. I like that answer. Rebecca, we got to get a clip of
And Steve Jobs would say, it's still bad for any product that you've kind of got. I think that developing things in secret and not paying attention to what's been done before, not being hung up on what's been done before, we're going to design the best way it could be done today. You've got to have a very closed environment. You can't have people that are really out in the open being judged by a whole bunch of other people. Even other divisions of the company really can't see it. I think that's very helpful to Apple. And you've also got to have one mind in the end that envisions the total product, software or hardware, and says, does this really feel good to me and play well? Does it seem awkward? Does it seem to have too many things? And saying no is a very big part of it. So always admire, I'm talking about Steve Jobs, really, but it was like when we started, I was easy. I had a market of one person, myself, and it was one mind doing all the hardware, all the software. Everything had to work well. So our starting product was very good along those lines.
Two last questions. So this week at this conference, we spent a lot of time talking about cloud computing. What's your definition of the cloud and the benefits you see over the years to come?
Cloud is really too hard probably to define concretely. So, just thinking this, the internet, the unknown areas. And at first we were afraid of the cloud. Would I put my valuable stuff on the cloud when hard disks are so cheap? And the answer to me was always, eventually we will, because the advantage of the cloud is you don't have to maintain it. You don't have to manage it. You don't have to watch for viruses. You don't have to do the updates. It all happens naturally and invisibly, and that's good. But I thought, well, you take your money and you put it in a bank. A bank is sort of a cloud. Your money's just in some account somehow, somewhere, and you trust it. So we will eventually trust all of our most valuable things to be on the cloud. Right now, I'm a little afraid of the cloud, and I think it's going to get worse and worse and worse in some behaviors.